We're going to take 50 minutes to cram in 6 months at least of extraordinary effort on the part of this committee, traveling to Washington, doing a million different things. It's barely the first step, barely scratching the surface. We'll joke around a little bit, but this is an amazingly serious topic as far as I'm concerned. I think all of us are concerned. We're going to break it down into four parts in the 50 minutes. My introduction shouldn't run more than 45. And then we'll have, it'll run 3 or 4 minutes. Then we'll have Joe speak to put the discussion in context. And then we're going to spend about 15 minutes or a little more maybe with the panel to just discuss in more detail the findings and conclusions that we've come to. Though nothing's in stone. There's differences among the committee, obviously. But the definition of the problem for most of us is a big deal. And then after defining the problem, we'll spend another 10 minutes on proposed solutions. That part, a little loose, here are ideas. The objective of today, there's no question in our mind what the objective of today is. We want you to share our view that democracy in America under our watch has been materially weakened. The second thing we want you to do, even though this reunion is a lot of fun, is commit in some small way or a large way to spend a little bit of time over the next 3 years trying to make a difference. So with that in mind, we've got, I think on the chairs, oh, that's much better. These things, sign up, drop them on the last pew. We'll be back in touch with you. Just say, yeah, I'm interested. It may be no more than writing out a check to some of the not-for-profits that we're talking about. Or it may be working very hard on a subgroup to really change some fundamental things. Sorry, I keep slipping this back and forth. Let me just quickly highlight some of the conclusions that we've come to. And these words for me are fairly carefully chosen. We've concluded that democracy as a form of government is a fragile gift. The sacred core of that gift is the single vote of each citizen. The value of the single vote of the citizens of the United States is being undermined. The process leads inevitably, in some of our views, from democracy to oligarchy over an extended period of time, when an individual vote counts less and smaller group determine who we the people are. The goal of our committee, as I mentioned before, is to just highlight, after all these meetings with right-wing people, left-wing people, moderates, every kind of people you can imagine, who were deeply involved in this issue, what they thought and what they were prescribing. So as I said before, the goal ultimately is to get your engagement. We're breaking the discussion down into two primary topics. The first is the ease of voting. And in our view, there's no greater moral outrage than one American systematically working to deny another American the right to vote or to diminish their vote. It strikes at the very heart of democracy, and I don't think that's hyperbole. Three little subtopics under that the panel will later embellish on. State legislatures around the country, they're making concerted efforts to diminish the individual votes of certain groups by, well, I won't go into the detail, we'll talk about that later. Redistricting, gerrymandering by parties as opposed to independent commissions. So more and more House districts are safe. I was in a meeting with Max Baucus a year or so ago. He said the single biggest reason for polarization in certainly the House is 30 years of redistricting and gerrymandering. There is a slide which I'll try to get to. I think we have it up there. Finally, the third topic under that is closed primaries. And we heard some statistics in Washington that make you shudder. So a closed primary is a primary where only that party can vote. And in some states that are reliably red or reliably blue, the primary chosen person is the one who certainly will win in that state. And if you look at the real numbers in some of those primaries where people who are passionate on the left or the right vote in a candidate by a very relatively small number of votes. That guy wins or that woman wins. They go on to the election in the state, and they absolutely win because the state's reliably red or blue. So a very small group of people in the primary side. The second thing, which you all know about, money in politics, I think these statistics are right, due in part to the growth of income inequality, which Joe spoke of earlier, recent Supreme Court decisions. The money in politics is astounding. I think this fact is right. 0.03% of the American people provide the bulk of campaign financing. We had one former congressman say, we all spend 40-60% of our time raising money. Of all the time we're in Washington, 40-60% of our time, who do you think we talk to? We only talk to wealthy people. How can we not, over an extended period of time, be affected by that? So that's from there. Now, let me move to part two. Joe Stiglitz, who some of you heard this morning. I have to confess that over time, Joe Stiglitz has irritated me. We were in physics class together, and Arnie Ahrens would put some huge question up on the board, something like that. Before the question was finished, Joe's hand would go up, and Joe would say, oh, I think it's the third equation question to the end, and it's very good. And I was sitting there not understanding the question. Then I had the pleasure of serving on as an Amherst trustee. I rolled off, and Joe rolled on onto the as a trustee. Right after he won the Nobel Prize, and somebody said to me, do you realize how close you came to getting the Nobel Prize? And then finally, Joe appeared on the list of the 100 most influential people in the world exactly the same year that I got on the list of the 600 most influential people right down the road here in Belchertown. Ladies and gentlemen, the great Joe Stiglitz.
Well, thank you very much for that. Let me try to put the issue in perspective. And to begin with, the question is, why do we need any government at all? And I'll look at it more from the political, from the economic point of view, but there are other reasons. One of them is that to make a society function, there has to be all kinds of rules and regulations. We have to act together. Just to think about New York City, where if you didn't have stoplights, it would be in perpetual gridlock, and people would be hitting each other, or you wouldn't be able to move. So for it's a metaphor that illustrates that for society to succeed, you have to have rules and regulations. You have to have rules and regulations that affect, that prohibit negative externalities, what economists call it, where you do harm to others. Talking this morning, I mentioned the problem of environmental pollution. That's an example of a negative externality. And if you didn't stop that kind of pollution, we would all be in much worse shape than we are. And the failure, as I mentioned this morning, the failure of China to do anything about it has led to a level of pollution where they are choking, literally choking to death. So that's an example, but there are also positive ways in which acting collectively, we make things better. You have to have public roads. All the basic innovations that have changed our standard of living today are based on basic research that government provides. And there's a whole theory about why it is necessary for government to provide that basic research. So what I want to emphasize is the importance of some degree of collective action. There's going to be a disagreement about how much and where the boundaries are, but that there needs to be some degree of collective action seems to me absolutely unambiguous. But then if you're acting collectively, you have to feel that the rules of the game, the decisions that are being made, are done in a fair way. And democracy is the way that we collectively make decisions about the collective interest. But if democracy is not working, then the sense of the fairness in our society, our of the rules of the game being done in a fair way will be undermined. So the first point on that side I don't want to make is that democracy is more than just the right to go to the polls once every 4 years. It's necessary to have that right, and the point that Mark made, that when you try to stop people from having that right, which is going on in a serious way in many states, that clearly undermines democracy. But democracy is more than that. As just a footnote, actually there's been a long history of attempts at disenfranchisement in the United States. It's something that we shouldn't be proud of, but there were poll taxes that were designed to try to stop African Americans after slavery from voting. So we, you know, and these techniques have been part of our history. So we ought to be aware that this is not the first time, but it is a very ugly thing that is going on right now. If there's going to be confidence in our voting, in our politics, there has to be a sense that voting matters. And what worries me is that we're now in a vicious circle, that because of the kind of gerrymandering that has gone on, the fact that the change in the House, no matter what the sentiment in the polls is, the view is the House won't change, that leads to a kind of disillusionment with the political process. So there's disempowerment, and disenfranchisement leads to disillusionment. And the consequence of disillusionment is that people don't vote. So we go to war to say we are defending the right of democracy. And here in the United States, in the 2010 election, election, only 20% of the young people voted. And it's the young people who have most at stake. And why aren't they voting? If you ask, the answer is they don't think it's going to make any difference. And there's a certain grain of truth in what they're saying. So those of you who took political science may remember, this may be a development that happened after we went there. There was an important idea of what outcomes ought to look like in a democracy. It ought to reflect what is called the median voter, the person in the middle. That is, a lot of people want, half the people want to spend a little bit more on this and a half want to spend a little bit less. And the outcome of a political process is, in a democracy, ought to be somewhere in the middle. And it makes everybody a little bit unhappy, but that's the nature of consensus formation. And a lot of the discussion is to try to get people to get a greater consensus about what is the appropriate. If you look at a lot of the decisions going on in our political process, there is no way that you can describe the outcomes as reflecting that median voter, that person in the middle. I mean, to give you one example, there is a broad consensus that we need stronger financial regulations. The IMF, the head of the IMF just said it a couple days ago, most economists believe this. 75% of Americans believe this, and yet it isn't happening. And so that's an example of where money matters. Not a surprise, a lot of the banks invested an awful lot in politics, and they got a higher return out of those political investments than they got out of their economic investments. So it's not a surprise that the politics come out the way it does. So the final two observations I want to make is, first, that the outcome of our political process, just like the outcome of our economic process, really depends on all the rules of the game. You know, who can vote? What are the limitations on campaign contributions? We're the only democracy that has these peculiar no limitations and that says corporations are people and allows money to have that amount of sway. You know, the Scandinavian, the European countries have democracies. At least they did before they had the euro. But they have a democracy, but they have tried to make sure that that democracy is more reflective of the views of their citizens by putting constraints. They find it very difficult to understand how we can let money have such influence. So it's not an inherent property of democracy that you wind up with a system of $1, one vote. You can shape democracy with one person, one vote. As an example of the kinds of rules of the game that matter, Australia has a rule that everybody has to go to the voting booth. They don't require you to vote. They say that's it, but you have to go there. The point, of course, is much of the campaign money goes to getting out the vote. And so what they've done is try to reduce the areas where you need money. A lot of countries have free television time. That also reduces the need. We almost got that free television time when I was in the Clinton administration. We almost got that into a bill. We had a bipartisan consensus, and then it fell apart at the last minute. So we've recognized that, you know, this is one of the areas where money goes, most money goes. We could stop that. We own the airways. When I say we, the U.S. citizen own the airways. When we turn it over to, we own the right, we control the rights to cable and all that. When we turn over those rights, we could say a condition of getting the right to the airwave is that when there are elections, you give free access, and you could have rules of the game. So it's a decision that we've made, in a sense, that allow rules of the game that have led to money having as much influence as it has. The final thing is really just a very depressing note. When you talk about a lot of the turbulence around the world, the Arab Spring in Tunisia, that was a result partly of the high level of unemployment, particularly youth unemployment, but it was partly the result of the fact that they felt, large fractions of their society felt, that the system was unfair. And if the rules by which the system operates are viewed to be arrived at in an unfair way, people will come to feel that the system is unfair. And that really is undermining not just our democracy, but our society and our economy.
Okay, thank you, Joe. Now we'll move to the panelists' reflections on their own personal views. I'm sorry. We'll move to the panelists' comments on their some of their own personal views of the last 4 or 5 months. We're going to be guided by what are technically called the rules of civil discourse, where comments are brief, 30 seconds, a minute, no long rambling. We'll go back and forth. We will try and have a few questions at the end, so we'll do that. And I failed to mention one other thing. Tomorrow morning at 8:30 at our center, we're going to keep this discussion going. So anybody who wants to come over there at 8:30, for an hour, we'll try to refine some of the things we talked about today. So, Neil, why don't we start? We'll start with you.
Okay. One of the tasks I was asked to do is, if we're talking about democracy, what are we talking about? And it's, I think, important to focus for a minute on, all right, what is democracy? What's democracy all about? Sort of the conventional wisdom definition of democracy, of course, is it's a political system where all eligible voters have an equal say in the government, either directly or through a representative system. But there are other definitions. I mean, there's no consensus on what the definition should be for democracy, but Joseph Schumpeter had a definition in his book, 1942, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. And he said, democracy is a system where those people who get to make the decisions compete for that privilege by competing for the votes of the people. And that's the advantage of that is that it gives you an operational hook here, because he's saying it's based on competition, and you can look at the system and, well, to what extent is competition being circumvented, and you can make judgments on the quality of your democracy. But Ian Shapiro, a political science professor from Yale, in a book called The State of Democratic Theory, says, well, Schumpeter's definition is a great definition. The only problem is those people that are competing for the votes are also competing for money. And guess whose interests rise to the surface when legislation gets made? And so clearly pointing to the money in politics issue, his definition of democracy is a system designed to prevent one segment of society dominating other segments. So that's a kickoff. Any?
Okay, hi, I'm Mitch Meisner, by the way. I was not on the original program, but I'm filling in, I think, for Steve Redeker, more or less, but I've been active with this group. I do have a political science degree from Amherst, so we'll see if that's helpful. I have a PhD in Chinese politics, but it would be interesting to see if that gives any insight. My hobby horse in this long discussion that has a lot of different directions it's taken, it has been voting. That was already mentioned somewhat, but I think it's interesting partly because we're going to get into talking about a student alumni project. And even though a lot of the focus on impediments to voting or attempts to limit the expansion of the ease of exercising the franchise that have taken place are really about minority voters in a number of states, they also affect students. Students, I mean, it's said over and over again that students don't particularly find it interesting to vote, or they don't feel there's legitimacy involved, or it's futile. But in fact, it's also somewhat difficult for students to register. There's constant movements to force students to register at whatever their home address used to be rather than on campus, to make it hard to have online registration and registration booths at the campuses, et cetera. Because students, I think, are viewed as having a tendency, on the whole, to be liberal. That's just a fact today. So in terms of student interest in this area, we hope that there is some commonality of personal interest and not just a kind of altruistic motive. That's first. The second thing on voting rights is that this is this is an American project. One thing that's happened throughout American history that's really colored our history is a series of extensions of the franchise. Some of them are marked by cataclysm, like the Civil War, which led in part to the 15th Amendment. The women's suffrage, you sort of tend to forget about that, it was quite a struggle. The expansion of, the renewal of the ability of African Americans to vote after the Jim Crow suppression, and then the more common problems of today. There also were undercurrents of corruption at times. I read recently that in the early 19th century, people used to kind of go down in gangs or groups under a sort of machine political system in the urban areas to vote. There was no secret ballot. They'd have brawls on the way to the polling place to keep each other from voting. So it's not like, you know, all the problems that exist today. But by and large, I'd say the one thing we have going for us as a society is a gradual, sometimes painful, historical evolution of the right to vote, the use of the ballot box, and the ease of voting. And there's no reason in my mind that should move backwards, regardless of partisan views. Now, last comment at this moment, because I think I'll come back later if there's a little time to talk about the student project. The fact of the matter is this group has talked among ourselves many times about gridlock. as if that's the problem. And the sort of constipated legislative process in Washington today, and particularly Congress. But if you pay attention to what your state's doing, there's not necessarily a problem with gridlock. I mean, I live in the state of Michigan, and in the current historical era, there's a strong Republican majority and a Republican governor in both houses, and they're passing legislation right and left. It's not like it's hard to pass legislation. So in a sense, you vote for people, you get what you vote for. There's some gerrymandering at the state legislative level. It's not extreme. It's just that this is the level at which I kind of think more people ought to pay attention to political challenge, because among other things, this is where voter suppression is occurring and all these restrictions on voting. I'm going to stop there. I like one more shot at this.
Two quick comments that just came to mind. One of the people we talked about in Washington said, equating money with free speech is the worst decision since Dred Scott. And when we met with the millennials, as a millennial group, they're disgusted with the parties. So they're registering independent, which further excludes them from the primaries. So just as another little aside. Any comments?
Yeah, I want to pick up on your point about the states. I think that we came of age during a period in which reforms in American democracy were enacted at the federal level. We think of the Civil Rights Bill, the Voting Rights Act, all of those things which were done from Washington to try to improve on the democracy. What's going on now, though, is that a lot of the restrictions that we're chafing against and have realized as we've done our investigation are happening at the state level, but also some of the reforms that we're not sure are going to work, but the experiments are going on. Some of the states have tried open primaries. There are three states that are using laws to try to form campaign finance programs which will get away from big money. California and a couple of other states have formed nonpartisan public campaign, public redistricting commissions to draw the lines by a series of principles they're evolving. Now, not all of those reforms are doing everything they should, but it's a time of experimentation in the states. And it did seem to us that where before the action may have been marches on Washington, that now an awful lot of the action is in an area that many people are not looking at that much, and that's the state houses. And state reforms in states, even if one isn't sure that they're going to work, try it. We can, if it doesn't work, another state can do it another way.
Excuse me. Just a little bit of perspective on the group and how you might think of it. To relating back to our education, this might well be an extended American studies project with very high stakes. In a sense, it's ongoing dialogue. It's trying to sort out fact from rhetoric, and it's looking for what are the core truths or core issues. One of the correspondents, very active in this group and other group, Rip Sparks, has a quote at the end of his emails, which said, "Everyone's entitled to his own opinions, but not to his own facts." And that goes back to the Daniel Patrick Moynihan. So what we're focusing on and trying to get to are the facts. The opinions we know, and we're all caught in some way in the larger political debate. You know, I think we're probably all focused and able to focus on civil discourse, and that's sort of the ground rules here. So that's just one point. I'll just wait till another come to another one.
Okay. It does work. Now you've got these on your seat, but I'm just going to click through as we move to. There we go. Now that, by the way, down in the right corner is an election district. So you can see the genius of gerrymandering. Yeah, and that's not one of the worst ones. That's not a good one, but it's not one of the worst ones. There we go. These are other things that aren't on our top priorities, but when you look at lobbying and what's going on there, it's extraordinary. when GM had their recall and they had some problems, they hired, you know, I think 30 to 40 former legislative people to just lobby for them. And you got the equal time thing, appointed commission supporting, okay. Now, so that's the first cut at how some of the people on the panel just see some of the issues that are damaging democracy. So then the next step is, what do you do about it? Thanks to the extraordinary effort of, you know, Neil and crew, we had three full days in Washington meeting with, as I said, an incredible array of people and institutions from across the political spectrum. Neil's going to quickly walk you through this group. This is culled so that this group is very sympathetic to some of the things we're talking about today. They've been around for a while, and this is a group we'd recommend if you want to just write out checks or write out checks and do more. These five people, this five groups seem to be doing a pretty credible job.
All right, can I flip back for couple of these reform charts, comment on that first? If you could flip that back to reform number one for a moment. Here we go. This is a family of reforms that we discussed in quite a lot of detail. I think a lot of us are upset by the fact of efforts that are underway to restrict voting, and so we've had some comment on that. But the broader discussion we had here was one that was framed by Mickey Edwards in his book, The Parties Versus the People. And his thesis is that it's fundamental to the issues that we're facing that too much power has been delegated to our political parties for managing our political processes. And that goes for redistricting, which in 37 states are controlled by the party in power. That goes for the choosing of our candidates, where in most states, the majority of states, you have closed primaries. And only people in the registered in a given party can vote in the primary. Of course, that disenfranchises independents, which are roughly in the range of 40% of the electorate at this point. Parties have also passed sore loser laws in all but four states. And a sore loser law says, if you run in a party primary, you cannot run in a general election as an independent. And there are only four states where you do not have that sort of regulation. And so that's an example here of how the parties have controlled, as Mickey Edwards says, these private clubs are controlling our political processes rather than the people. So that's the basic thesis that I wanted to get across here, was Mickey Edwards' thesis.
And by the way, Mickey Edwards, Mickey Edwards, just quickly in case you don't know, is a conservative Republican congressman from Oklahoma. I think one of the three founders of the Heritage Foundation. And he was wrote a wonderful book and very clear thinker on this stuff.
Let's see, the next chart on Reform 2. This all has to do with the major issue here of money in politics. And when we were speaking with Alice Rivlin, she says, you know, the influence of money in politics is basic to what's wrong here. She says, we can't figure out any of our other problems until we figure out how we can lessen the influence of money in politics. And she says, see all these people that are putting huge amounts of money into the political system to bend the system to their will. She says, where's the outrage? You know, it's terrible that we have to get involved is the underlying message. if we want to change this, if we want problems to get solved, if we're frustrated with what goes on in Washington, the way to do that is to get involved and insist that changes be made. And that was her basic message here relative to money and politics. Three fundamental reforms that can change the system. The first, finding a way to reverse the Citizens United decision. There are a large, I think it's 16 states that have had either referendum or taken other action to endorse the idea of a constitutional amendment. There are a vast number of cities that have also have passed that sort of resolution. That's something we can get behind. The second in money and politics is creating a small donor-based voluntary public system of financing. And the underlying thought here is we can't have a democracy unless we have a democratic way of financing our elections. And there are legislative proposals in the Congress at present which would achieve this. And this has to be voluntary. And the idea is if you can get so many small donors to contribute, and then there's a multiple of that provided by public funding, and that would give an alternative to our current system of requiring that our candidates go to special interest to finance their campaigns. And if we require that as we do now, what can we expect? But the interests of those special interest groups will dominate. And then thirdly is the whole question of transparency. And there's a legislation as well in Congress called the Disclose Act, which just says if you're going to contribute to a campaign, it should be fully disclosed to the public so we know who is supporting what. So I just thought it was important to go through some of those reform steps. And these are the reforms that our group has discussed over these past several months, that these reforms, just these major reforms we just discussed here, are the ones that will make a big impact in changing the way Washington works. Yes, okay. When we turn to the discussion of the action plan, these are all groups that we spoke with in Washington, and these are groups that are fighting to achieve some of those reforms that we just discussed. Common Cause and the Brennan Center for Justice, the Brennan Center is associated with New York University. Each of those groups have a meaningful extended agenda of initiatives that they're pursuing, consistent with the reforms we just talked about. The public campaign organization is focused exclusively on money and politics issue. And what they're seeking to do is make money and politics an issue in campaigns so that if you don't support a public financing alternative, that you make that a political issue. And you try to get people to vote based on that issue and whether or not it's endorsed by the candidate. No Labels is somewhat different. No Labels strategy here is not on pushing in these individual reforms. What No Labels is seeking to do is to change the political culture in Washington. And they have instituted what they call problem-solving groups. And at present, they have representatives and senators that have signed up to be problem solvers groups, problem solvers, to put aside their labels, Republican, Democrat, Independent, and say, we're here to solve problems. And they have 90 people in Congress signed up at this point. And that's another thing that we can do in terms of talking with our candidates. Are you a No Labels problem solver? And then the Millennial Action Project, we'll talk about that a little further when we talk further about this Student Alumni Association proposal.
One of the conclusions we came to is define the problem, research the problem, go through all that. But realistically, a small group of us in our 70s are not going to make the huge difference. So everywhere we can leverage ourselves, we want to do that. So one way is just through money, supporting groups that are already deeply involved. And the second group is to pair with, and we did have some Amherst students on the committee, pair with students and other alumni and other schools to leverage the kinds of things we're trying to do. And you know, the stuff that some schools are doing with social media, changing investment guidelines, doing a whole bunch of other things are really, really impressive. So that would be the second major leverage point.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
And then we'll open up for questions.
Mark, there are several of us who have volunteered to be on a continuing committee to work on now a very ill-defined continuing project to leave a legacy in terms of some collaboration between alumni like ourselves and others who may get interested and the current generation of students at Amherst and perhaps elsewhere from time to time, but focused around these issues that we've mentioned. And we're just beginning to talk about what to do and how to do it, whether it's to set up a, for example, an annual forum during the winter break period to bring people onto campus and discuss these issues that students could plan, maybe along with interested faculty. Maybe it would be bringing the other area colleges in some way. Maybe it would be bigger. And it's very hard to predict if students take the lead, which in a way they should really over time, where they're going to go, because they tend, when they get interested in the subject, they tend to move quicker than we do. But this is the general idea, and it's interesting because we just started talking, and I can already see on campus that the people in administration faculty, there are a mixture of views on this. And one of I guess what I want to leave is with this. One of the views that's current is that this generation of students is so worried and panicked about their own personal futures that they're not interested in anything outside themselves, even though in Joe's talk and other people's talk this morning, the overall environment that's affected by legislation and policy affects everyone's life chances at this point. But it's sometimes hard to organize that into a program. I will say this. If anybody looked at the collage of pictures from this, our class that's sitting in the former Chi Phi, now there's a very nice picture of me actually my wife thought it was nice and dapper looking, wearing a suit, holding a sign in the midst of a group of other, mostly students and some faculty and others, 1963 October when Kennedy came to campus to speak, the signs said, either one, civil rights now, or my favorite was, Mr. President, we support your civil rights bill. A fiery anti-Kennedy slogan, right? At that time, I'd say just two comments. Number one, it was hard going just getting the ability to hold this demonstration. There was tremendous worry, concern, pushback, and consternation on the part of the administration about doing anything that might put this school in a bad light or embarrass someone. The second thing was that, in fact, this was a very small group. There was, I would say, a general attitude of quietism on the campus at that time. There wasn't much activism. It was the beginning and the sort of rumbles, the civil rights movement, and the Vietnam hadn't started. It was tough going, being this little kind of minority. And I think, you know, I'm surprised, in fact, talking to so many people that our class turned out as politically engaged and as sort of liberal as they did. I would have predicted you'd have had mostly people who are uninterested and very conservative. Maybe it was my short-sightedness. But things change, and people have an impact. And I believe there are always people interested through a combination of zeal and maybe academic interest and patriotism, whatever it is, personal interest, that are looking for opportunities. And that's really what motivating us, as well as concern, wouldn't you say, about these issues that we're raising, because they're universal and they're historic. They're not just now. That's all. I hope that people will be interested. I hope we get support. I hope that if you have friends in the faculty and administration, you will be behind the scenes helping if we get something going. It's, as I said, it's just the beginning.
not a bad substitute, you know, at the last minute, put in to pull a guy like that in. Let's see, we got the last slide that's going to sit up there. We've got time probably for a couple of questions, and then we're certainly going to do a lot of this tomorrow morning over breakfast at 8:30. But if there are a couple of questions that I know the people photographing this want the microphone brought. Yeah, so where's... Okay. Yep. Hold it, wait 1 second. Okay. Got your sneakers on. Rush.
I'm just going to Kim Hetzko from Madison, Wisconsin. And I was just going to point out from a very progressive liberal city that 2 weeks ago we had a commencement ceremony at Amherst, exactly at this hour 2 weeks ago to this day. Not at Amherst, but in Madison. And they had the invited speaker, who they allowed to participate, was a Republican, former presidential candidate, and one of the founders of No Labels, and the former governor of Utah, and that was John Huntsman. And he was exceedingly well received at the graduation ceremony with a standing ovation after he described No Labels and trying to pursue a center-of-the-road solving of problems in this country. And the audience of 43,000, now this is getting multiplied a little bit, but it was 43,000 in the stands, totally stood and applauded him. No protest, no disinviting, but the desire to move forward, even in a very progressive liberal environment with a Republican speaker. So I wholeheartedly endorse the two slides proposals that the committee has come forth with, and I would like to so move.
Thank you very much. Sure, over there.
Bill Bud Tucker. I disagree with just about everything that's been said on this panel, but...
we're out of time.
I'm going to save that for tomorrow morning, I promise. But I just want to say, if you want to see that demonstration that Mitch was talking about reenacted in a dramatic fashion, please come to the showing of my play tonight. There's even a character in it named Mitch, who I think was probably modeled on Mr. Meisner there. They weren't able to put it on the schedule. They messed up putting it on the schedule, but it's at 9:30 tonight at Ki-Fi. I hope you can all fit into that small screening room with me.
Thanks a lot. And that kind of pushback and all is hugely welcome, not just saying it, just to refine what we have to do.
I got just one point here. This is about open primaries. Now, I'm not a believer in them until they are realistically the only open primary is a primary that enables people to participate in the deciding election. And I've got here a paper this week which I think says it better than anybody. It's from the president of the Massachusetts Independent Voters. That is, people who have identified with neither party. And now, of course, I identify with a party, but nonetheless, increasing numbers of people don't. And as a result, the parties are becoming more and more particular, thus further and further apart. And he says, why not open the parties, the primaries, to everybody? And I would have to say, given the choice, I'm for it.
Okay, thank you. We're literally out of time. Smokey, did you have anything else to say? I wasn't sure.
Just one. Judy, we have 5 more minutes.
One point on the organizations that we've talked to and they're listed here. Mark talked about financial support. The other thing is just being a member. For instance, No Labels went from 1,000 people to over 500,000 in less than 3 years and is growing very rapidly, both at the national initiative, state, and local government. Secondly, each of these organizations, when you're part of it, your education is a continuing education because then you understand how the what's going on with the voter laws, what's going on with sore loser. A lot of things that, personally, I follow this very closely, but I had no idea how these pieces fit together and what the result was on the machinery of democracy. The third part is within each any of those organizations, there are things that any of us can do at our own in various levels as voters, as any other form we are part of naturally. So it's very far from a situation where we can't do anything, and these organizations, you know, it's a very much a solid two-way street. You learn a lot, you help, and things move forward.
Thank you all for being here. I hope you enjoyed it. We had a great time.